Hello and welcome to Women for Elections in Conversation with podcast series. As a way to extend our connections with you throughout this global pandemic, Women for Election has developed an online event series where some of the most prominent leaders from the world of politics chat with some of our leading Irish journalists about political life, the issues of the day and the need for gender equality. In this, our 10th podcast episode, Women for Election chairperson Alison Cowser is in conversation with former Taoiseach and now MEP Frances Fitzgerald. With decades of experience in politics and a long-standing record in advocating for women's rights, Frances talks about how she got involved in political life, the changes she has witnessed in politics over three decades, and she discusses some of the things she thinks need to happen to help realise a 50-50 representation of women in Irish politics by 2030. We hope you find this episode interesting, and as ever, please feel free to subscribe to the Women for Election podcast. You can also sign up for our newsletter on our website, womenforelection.ie, and if you have some cash to spare, please donate via our website to help us to do more. Good afternoon, everyone, and you're very welcome back to our In Conversation series, which we've been running very successfully now for over a year. I'm welcome particularly back people who've been with us before and to all our newcomers. I can't see you, but delighted that you're here to join us. I'm very delighted today to have two fantastic leaders in the room with me. We have Alison Cowser, our chairperson, who's thankfully been able to step in to replace Alison O'Connor, who unfortunately was unable to make the interview at the last minute. So I'm delighted to have Alison, who's been the chairperson of Women for Election since 2014, and who's also a very successful entrepreneur and leader in Ireland. So delighted to have Alison. And I'm particularly delighted today to be joined by one of Ireland's leading female politicians, who's been a very successful leader over a number of decades now. Reflecting on your journey to politics, I'm delighted to welcome Frances Fitzgerald, MEP, and former Taoiseach, Ministers for Justice, Business and for Children, and also a Senator, and formerly Chair of the National Women's Council, which was the starting point of prominence for Frances in Ireland. So I was delighted in my previous role to work with Frances when she was Minister for Justice particularly, and all the leadership she provided in those spaces, particularly in relation to marriage equality and gender-based violence and many, many other areas, but those was where I intersected. So, Frances, you're very welcome. We're delighted to have you here. And I'm going to hand over now to Alison and looking forward to our conversation over the next hour or so.
Thanks, Katrina. And Frances, you're very welcome. I'd like to echo that. The thanks from Katrina for joining us today. You're joining us from Brussels, are you?
Dublin, actually.
Dublin. Oh, you're in Dublin. Great. Okay, even better. So just to everybody out there, we're hoping for a fairly interactive chat today. If you wanted to use the Q&A function on Zoom, and we'd be delighted to handle your questions. We'll have a bit of a chat first and then go to the questions towards the end. So please feel free to send us your comments and your questions and we will get to those. So Frances, I suppose I should start today by congratulating you. I believe just hit the news yesterday and you've been appointed Vice President of the EPP Group in Europe. So I suppose a big role for you, a big role for Ireland in that position?
Yes, I mean, it's a great opportunity. I decided to contest the election. There was a vacancy in the presidency, which is effectively the national executive of the biggest party in the parliament, the EPP group, to which I came along. And yes, I had a Swedish colleague and a colleague from Croatia as well who were interested in the post, and I came through. So it's a good opportunity, really, you know, to influence at the highest level of our party in Europe and to influence the parliament. And I think that's good. It's good for Ireland. And it's an interesting challenge for myself. You know, lots more work, but women are used to taking on lots more challenges and I suppose opportunities as well. So, yes, it's when you go for election, you know, Alison, it's always nice to win. I've had experience of both, as many, many people do in politics. It's one of the the points about politics. It can be quite an up and down career. And I guess business can be as well, you know, so it's maybe not too different from that point of view. But thank you very much. And thanks to Katrina for the introduction as well and for the work you do.
So you mentioned you're no stranger to elections. So at some point, you must have got that light bulb moment that just said, you know, I think I'm going to run. And I think many of the women and men perhaps who are listening to us today are considering that themselves, whether it's the upcoming local elections in 2024 or further afield in terms of general election. What was it way back, if you can remember, because I know you've been in politics quite a long time. What was it that gave you that?
I was 42 at the time, actually. I wasn't one of these people, as I often say, who woke up at 15 or 16. People take it as a swipe at Leo and said, you know, I want to be Taoiseach, I want to be minister. Never thought about it. Did a social science degree in Dublin, did my master's in London, in the London School of Economics. And then when my first son was born in England, and I got involved with the National Childbirth Trust. And kind of that was about women having voices in maternity care. And look at where that's gone, my goodness, over the last number of decades. And, Savita and all of the issues that have come up around SRHR. And then when I came back to Dublin, I kind of almost accidentally, but was very interested in the work that the Women's Political Association was doing at the time. And I got involved in that, really to go to the public meetings that they had. You know, they were doing public meetings. And I, to this day, I can't quite remember the first moment. I think back in around before that, I remember going to a meeting with in the RDS, which the Women's Council had organized, but that was 10 years before I got involved. I just happened to go along to that as well. I was kind of interested in it. I wasn't involved in politics at all, and my family, you know, weren't political. I wasn't involved in politics at all before I ran. So you asked me the moment. I got involved in the National Women's Council through that route of the WPA. I was a rep to the council, and I really loved the work that the council were doing. And I ended up as chair of the National Women's Council. And in that position, we were lobbying government ministers, you know, on every topic. You know, we were going in week in, week out, and that was a voluntary position. We were going into government buildings, you know, lobbying on women's pay, lobbying on social welfare. I remember going in to see Charlie McCreevy, and he said, "Sit down there now, girls. I'm watching Cheltenham here, and we'll catch up in a minute." I remember that moment distinctly, you know, for obvious reasons. And, you know, we met lots of the ministers. We were involved in various campaigns, health campaigns, women and smoking, all this type of thing. And so I got involved in that world of trying to influence government. And I got a lot of, you know, information and understanding. And I remember going into the Dáil one day. We went in to meet probably somebody like, you know, Nuala Fennell, Gemma Hussey, some of the women who were in there at that time. And I remember looking down at the floor of the Dáil and seeing all these men. And I was actually quite shocked. You know, I really thought, gosh, it really hit me at that moment. I really do remember it. And then as I was finishing up with the National Women's Council, I was approached to run. In the general, in the local elections, I think it was, somebody suggested, I was not interested at that time. I'm still chair of the Women's Council. And then a general election came around. I had was about to finish my work in the Women's Council. My 4-year voluntary term was coming to an end. I was working as a part-time social worker, and I had been doing more and more media, so I sort of got better known. And then I was approached by a number of political parties. I had joined Fine Gael earlier, but never got involved. I had joined back in the 80s, just out of interest. And then I didn't just go to local meetings. I kind of left it there at that point. And that was really what happened. I got asked to run. I finished my social work at that time. I was invited to run. I went before a convention for Dublin South East. It was Gareth Fitzgerald who asked me, would I consider running? And I kind of said yes and got involved. And I got elected a couple of months later, I think it was weeks, and I knew very little about politics, really, except from the outside, and had to learn. And as I said, it's been up and down ever since then. That was the easiest election, the first one. They got tougher after that. And politics, as I began to see what politics was really like, I had a lot of learning to do. And you can kind of sometimes you learn the hard way in politics. You know, I don't think, unless you've grown up in a political family, you really don't have a real sense of it, you know, what it was actually like then. That was back in 92, so that's quite a while ago. So I'm sorry, that's a long-winded story.
So I suppose, I mean, that feeds into a question that we are asked a lot by women who attend our courses and that we support to go forward. The question is often asked, you know, what qualifies you to be a politician? And it's, I suppose, you know, be keen to hear your views on that. You've clearly seen it all the way through your career so far. What do you think makes a good politician?
What do I think makes a good politician? Actually, you come across a huge variety of people in politics. So that's really hard a question to answer. You'd imagine that most politicians would be extremely sociable and would sort of link with everybody. You actually come across wide range of, say, personality types. And I suppose because I've been, in politics for so long, I've kind of seen it all. But what makes a good politician? What helped me was sticking to my values. Okay, so I was a social worker. I was interested in social problems. I was interested in effecting change. I think you have to have a strong motivation, you know, that you want to do public good and that you're really interested in listening and hearing about the social issues, the problems, either individual or social, facing people. And I think, you know, you have to be very open to reaching out to people. You really do. And you have to have a good, you have to be able to kind of analyze what's going on in your community and, you know, see those critical issues that are emerging and be interested in doing something about them. You have to have, clearly anybody who's thinking about politics will have a motivation. And I think the motivations that work are wanting to respond to people's problems, issues, the community's issues. You have to have that connection. That's really the key, because a huge amount of your work, that's what it is about. It's not really about speeches in the Dáil. It can be, of course, very often about legislation, and that's really important. But I think, you know, my own values were about, they were about equality, they were about inclusion, they were about diversity. And like, I was amazed really where my social work, when I was actually Minister for Justice, informed so much of what I did. And when I was Minister for Children, because I'd worked with children and families for 20 years in Ballymun and in London one of the community care areas there, and in a specialist clinic for children and families. So, you know, that helps. You've got to have a lot of energy. You need a lot of energy. It's very demanding. I think a lot of hard work. I mean, all of the politicians I know work incredibly hard. But I never say that's unique to politics, you know, because I think people work hard working full time in the home. People work hard in all sorts of businesses. But it's very challenging from that point of view. And also, I think the public aspect is increasingly coming into play, Alison, you know, it's increasingly an issue for younger women and younger female politicians. You know, the whole social media and how it can treat people, that is certainly a big factor at the moment. And we have some very disturbing evidence about younger women deciding to come off social media entirely. And of course, it's a very big part now being a politician, is managing all of that. And you have to be able to deal. And also, things are very public. You know, I've always kept my family completely out of politics. Maybe at the very beginning, I had, I think, one photograph with my children, but never since. I would advise anybody to take that approach. I mean, I think, you know, your family's your family, and your public and political life is different, would be my advice. But lots of different qualities, you know, can help you. You do need to be resilient. I think I've discovered that myself through my experiences, you know, resilience.
And obviously, you know, spanning the various ministries you've been in, the various institutions you've been in, maybe the Irish, European, whatever, are you seeing a different culture emerging in terms of women being involved in politics and how that's influencing the system?
Oh, yes. I mean, it makes a huge difference. I mean, it's disgraceful that we only have 22% of women in the Dáil. And in fact, I don't think it's sustainable for very much longer. I don't think the women and indeed the men of Ireland, particularly the women, I don't think they'll tolerate it much longer. So I think all of the political parties have to totally, wake up to this in an even bigger way than they have to date. No question. It makes a huge difference. It's about the critical mass, you know. So the difference.
What do you think the parties could actually do Frances, because, you know, we have the quota, which is at 30% for bringing candidates forward to national parliament, to the Dáil. But within the parties themselves, clearly the impetus is win the election at all costs. That's what parties are there to do. How do you think they can actually work within their existing structures or new ones, perhaps, to really make change happen? Because when those difficult decisions are being made, perhaps about an incumbent male who's there, and to bring in a running mate that may dislodge that individual, you know, how do we ensure that women are put in winnable seats as opposed to just there to make the quota? How do you think that's going to work its way through established parties particularly?
You know, it's like everything in life. It depends how much you want it. Mm-hmm. And I read a phrase the other day. It said, let's take the burden, it quotes, of gender equality off the shoulders of women and let's put them onto the leaders. And I think that's one really important point. Actually, leaders have to take more responsibility in relation to this, because the leaders are often men, as we know. And so if you take more responsibility, then it's interesting how you can find ways. And I think that's a good quote, actually, for us to think about, because the responsibility really does have to be. We have to demand that responsibility from male political leaders right across the board. Do I think more can be done by all of the parties? Yes, I do. I think the male network still works incredibly to the advantage of men. Very often, of course, they are already in place. But, you know, you do have men retiring. You do have vacancies. You can run more than one or two. You can give supports. You can put the party resources behind different candidates. And by the way, we're seeing, you know, bits of all of this, no question about it. But if you really decided that you're going to have, let's say, whatever percentage of your candidates, of course, are going to be women, let's say 30% as it is now, and then it goes to 40% or 50% at a certain point. Well, then, you know, who are your 50% of women that you're going to support, and who are your 50% of men? Now, the electorate will decide. And of course, if people, you know, women have to be doing the business, they have to be reaching out, they have to be seen as credible candidates. There's a huge amount to do. And there is a bit of a time lag, because women do have to build up the experience. But, you know, one of the things I've seen happening a lot, Alison, over the years, which really bothers me, is I've seen an awful lot of women, and indeed men, go in and out of politics. So I could give you a list of, you know, dozens of women who've gone in for one term, gone out, gone in maybe for two terms, disappeared. And these are all women who were interested in politics. And, you know, perhaps more could have been done to keep them involved and to support them. We've lost a lot of women in Fine Gael recently, tremendous, terrific women. And, you know, I wonder how many of them will run again. I think that's a shame if they don't. But people can get disillusioned as well. It's quite hard to lose. And, you know, I also came across a phrase recently that, you know, politics for many women is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And I think I'm testament to that. And it's not a bad way to think about it. That the best political careers, you know, have had losses and good and bad times. So, and it can be hard to sustain yourself, even financially and from a childcare point of view and everything, given the demands of politics. But, you know, that is another kind of way to look at it, that you do have to build up the experience, and, you know, more women need to build up the experience. But there are women who are building up the experience and then who leave. And that's quite a loss, because if you've already been in there and you have the experience, it's a great start.
You mentioned the idea of perhaps male leaders really taking this on and taking it on as a mission, in one sense, to make change happen. I'm interested in a quote from that you made in the Proud to Serve book, which has just been published by Maria Hegarty and Martina Murray, which I suppose charts the main many women's voices that have come through Fine Gael over the years. And it's a quote from yourself in your profile, and you say, I'm sick of it automatically being men at the cabinet table, and I'm tired of seeing poorer quality men getting positions ahead of higher quality women. I believe in the need for a 50-50 cabinet. So I suppose you've come somewhat of a journey on that, but perhaps your party leader hasn't, in the sense that in the same book, Leo Varadkar has stated that he's looking forward to the day when 50% of our TDs are women, And that would give Future Taoiseach a bigger group of women to select from, and a government where half the ministers are women. So in one sense, he's giving himself a little bit of wriggle room there, that he's going to wait for a 50-50 cabinet until there's 50-50 in the Dáil. What's your view on that?
I'm still working on that with him. You know, I was at a dinner one night, name dropping, in Dublin Castle when Justin Trudeau was here. And I was part of a conversation between him and Leo and myself, where Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, was saying, you know, come on now, we have to have 50% of women in cabinet. I've done it, even though I don't have 50% of women in my parliament. So I think the option is there. You know, we've had a quota operating on the side of men for a long time. And I think very often you can get that sort of sometimes it's unconscious, sometimes it's conscious connection that you know, men will have to men that they have served with. And sometimes, you know, good women can be overlooked. Or other excuses about geography or something else can be made, which actually, when you put them to the test, you know, they're just another criteria, really. You know, now, of course, I understand realpolitik. This all comes into it. So, yes, I don't think you have to wait for 50%. My God, how long is that going to take to have 50% women in cabinet?
Interesting, actually. The Women for Election had an event on International Women's Day, and the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, was asked his view on when did he see, what did he see as the future of gender balance in politics. He said, well, of course, it's 50-50. And Dermot MacDonald asked him, so when do you see that happening? And his response was, well, I think we should be aiming for 2030. So that's quite an ambitious time plan. You know, if you don't plan, you're never going to get there. But, you know, what's your views on the changes that will be necessary to make that a reality?
He's a lot of work to do nationally and in his own party, in the same way that we in Fine Gael have. The smaller parties tend to have, you know, they tend to have more women because they've been founded more recently and they've taken the whole, you know, place that Irish women are in now on board. They've been able to, if you like, involve women and men in more equal numbers. That's quite striking, all right. Yes, there's a lot of work to do. I mean, there's a lot of work to do. But as I say, I think it's all about, it's a bit like women on state boards, you know, and the work that Bree Horan has done. Once you start monitoring, once you start setting a target, then of course, you know, you get more intense about it. You look at the policies, the practices, you're looking at the constituencies more carefully. Like once you have the criteria in your head that we actually are going to have, you know, we can't go on like this. We have to have in our party or in our national parliament, we're going to have to get to, you know, very quickly to 35 or 40% anyway. It's 40% in the European Parliament. And that's happened in the last couple of years. And it just feels much more, you know, normal to have that sort of balance.
And I'd be interested in your views. So what does it feel like? How, as a practitioner, as a politician, as a legislator, to be in a forum, to be in a parliament where it looks a little bit more like real life? How does that feel?
It just feels more balanced. Mm-hmm. And you certainly get that kind of range of experiences. I'm not saying that all women will say the same thing or all women will be different to what men say. No, not at all. But it's that mix that you get, you know, like if you're in a room with a mix of women and men, I just think you end up with a lot of issues being raised. And there is evidence that when women are in parliament, when women are in cabinets, that you get the social issues, the health issues. Now, that sounds like a little bit traditional to say that, but you get a better balance on those issues. Sometimes I think the tradition, I think, has been, you know, the high status on the economics, pure economics. Of course, that's very important. But of course, the reality of the world is that socioeconomics we need to be looking at in terms of citizens' lives. That's where we need to be focusing. So it feels just more natural, really, to answer your question. And I did notice in cabinet as well, when we went from just two women, Joan Burton and myself, and then we went to four women and Minister of State and so on, when we had five, I think, at one point, that, you know, you just see, it just gets into a different kind of atmosphere, I think. I mean, the work is the same, you go on with the work, but it's just, it's quite interesting to see. There's also more recent research that shows that female politicians are very active when it comes to legislation. I think that's an interesting point as well, that, you know, our networking skills. You need networking skills when you're trying to get bills through Parliament. And you need to do a lot of work in terms of even getting the item on the agenda at a practical level. There's a lot of linking with, you know, staff of the Dáil and so on. And I think, you know, that women can be very good at that when they have the opportunity. Not enough women have had the opportunity to bring forward enough legislation. But you certainly see very active, great activity from women in committees in the Dáil.
And on that committee scenario, I mean, a lot of the work we know in the Dáil and even at council level happens at the committee system. And yet we have so many very influential committees in Dáil Éireann at the moment that there are no women on. Looking at some of the changes that are necessary and the reforms that are necessary, there has been questions mooted about, you know, just it being completely, not outlawed, but just not allowed that you would have one gender only committees discussing important issues that relate to national and local issues. Is that something you'd be in favour of?
I mean, it's really problematic. I mean, I remember when I started, you'd never have a woman on a finance committee because they were seen as status. They were the status committees, you know. You wouldn't get on foreign affairs either. That was far too... There was far too much status in that to have any woman on it. I mean, you know, I mean, look at, I mean, we have very disturbing evidence, by the way, Alison, just this week or last week from the UN about the COVID-19 task forces around the world, that you've had task forces where you've had no woman. I mean, how can you talk about the pandemic given the differential impact it's having on women? How can you formulate social policy without having women and men working together? I mean, you will not get the female experience, women's experience, inputted if you don't have them there at the table. And I've suggested various ways, even here in Ireland, that can be dealt with. You know, you shift the criteria of who's involved in the committee. You know, you bring in somebody from, now, obviously, when it's a pure government cabinet committee, you have a problem. But, you know, you can be imaginative about it. But I have been amazed at times when I've been in a room with maybe 20, 30, 40 men and maybe two women. I'm amazed at the lack of consciousness sometimes from the men in the room about this. I'm really surprised.
How can we change that, Frances? So how do we get to a point where this isn't a woman's issue, that this is a society issue, a political issue, whatever, but that you know, it's not women pushing all the time, but that we have men as allies that see this as being equally important?
Oh, I think we're having more and more male champions, actually. I mean, I think male champions are very important. You know, you take a century and you see the work that they've done on women and walls, and that's symbolic, but it's really important. You know, I mean, you've had Alistair Blair there, you know, leading on that with wonderful women on his team leading as well. I mean, there's lots of examples, actually. That's really important, that point you raise about male champions. And I think society is going to demand it. You know, it's a back and forth between society and the institutions. And let's face it, in companies, the economic arguments are holding sway because quite clearly a company's productivity goes up with even the addition of one woman onto an 8-person board. And you can see Christine Lagarde's work in this regard, where she's talking about the economic advantages of women's involvement. So the case has been made economically even, which is terribly important, of course, to everyone, that equal opportunities is just so good for GDP, quite apart from, you know, individual equal opportunities and progress for individual women. But I think it's the, you know, politics like is one of the, it's really one of the last bastions, I think, and the church. But there has been huge changes. I mean, you asked me that question earlier and I didn't really get to it. But I mean, the culture has changed in politics. You know, the importance of gender equality is, you know, it's certainly much more center stage. What we're not seeing is the representation, you know, the actual election of more women in the kind of numbers that we need yet.
Another new initiative this week, in fact, the Cam Corda has convened a new forum to develop policies to create a family-friendly and inclusive parliament. And Women for Election have been asked to participate in that. We're very happy to be part of that group. Having come through the Dáil and seeing how the system works, how the culture works, the hours, the perhaps, you know, lack of what would be in any other job would be considered rights, employment rights, and yet they're not there for many members within the Dáil, male and female. What changes would you like to see that would make it a more family-friendly and inclusive parliament?
Well, Helen has done a great job on the maternity issue. That's certainly raised awareness incredibly. And, you know, fair play to her, you know, for the end result there. But yes, I mean, obviously all the basics should apply to politics. But then you do come up against, and I think there's a lot of personal choice in this. Some women, you know, would want to, and many women in business, you know, who are self-employed, would continue to combine even very early childhood, you know, post-pregnancy with taking, you know, continuing to have a role in their business and continuing to try and balance the two, which I didn't have to do when I have three sons. When my children were small, I wasn't involved. Well, I had three under 10 when I went into politics, but being a
daughter, they were quite small.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they were small, but they weren't the babies, which I think is really, really tough time for to combine politics and that at a very early babyhood, if you like, childhood. But they were young, but I was a Dublin TD, and that made all of the difference, you know, in terms of support systems and travel and all of that. I think so those basic rights are really important. I mean, you know, some of the timings of work and the dole are, you know, just, you know, absolutely unnecessary to be, you know, they're based on a very old model of when the dole meets, you know. Now you're balancing people coming from outside Dublin as well, of course. So I mean, sometimes when we used to say, you know, have better hours, you know, the women who were coming from outside, and indeed the men, and many of whom had young families, would say, absolutely not. That means we're up here 5 days a week and we're away from our family for longer, you know. So I think things have changed, and it's great that Sean is doing this. I mean, you know, one of the things he's done is he's, dole reform has brought the votes together, you know, at particular times. I think it's a Thursday lunchtime now. And I mean, that doesn't mean there won't be votes at other times, but there's a little bit more organization, just saying, you know, a vote could be called at 11 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock, or there's more organization, and that frees people up somewhat. I think that's important. And you know, all of the normal family-friendly things. I mean, it is difficult, the whole, you know, work-life balance. It's pretty difficult with politics because of the, and then you have the demands of, you know, of a constituency going, a lot of the work is at night, a lot of the work. And it's very hard to control that because you can't, because the people that you're meeting with are themselves working in their own jobs during the day, say community groups, residence groups, and so on. So you do find yourself doing quite a bit of evening work and also weekend work as a TD, certainly. So I mean, it's not, you know, it is one of those jobs that there's, you need to have a lot of flexibility around. But of course, flexibility can be very good. I liked the kind of flexibility it gave, you know, that you there was flexibility in it as well, which you can manage.
Mm-hmm. I suppose one of the questions, and I think many of us would be thankful to Hannah McAtee for, I suppose, sacrificing her privacy to some extent to raise this issue. But, you know, a lot of people would ask the question, how did it get to that? You know, how did we have to wait till we had a female Minister for Justice in that position for this issue to be brought to the fore? And are there many other issues that, you know, we should just say, bring them to the table and sort them out now? Let's not wait until it becomes a crisis, a personal crisis that becomes a national issue, which is probably very unfortunate for her particularly.
It's very true. I mean, I think is she the first cabinet minister to have a baby while in office? She is.
Senior cabinet minister, I think, yeah.
Like the personal experience to push the agenda and to really shape it. And this is what has happened here. But you may well ask, I mean, politics is the sort of job, I think, that people, you know, they very rarely think about, you know, time off from it. And it's so competitive, I think, as well, Alison, that, you know, even in terms of saying taking maternity leave or paternity leave, which we should be talking about as well, or parental leave, people are very loath. There's always a competitor on your back, always, always. And people are very reluctant to take any time out. I mean, that's my experience. And even myself, I've at times, you know, given into that by doing things at times that, you know, with looking back, you'd sort of say, ah, gosh, you know, shouldn't have cut corners there, should have just done, you know, some more X or Y. haven't got a huge amount of that. I haven't got a huge amount, but I certainly went to some meetings I could have given a miss to, you know, and spent more time at home, particularly meetings, you know, you often have these late night constituency meetings that go on for a long time. That was the tradition. I think people, you know, and of course with Zoom, it's getting ever more efficient, these type of meetings, which it's actually quite interesting from the point of view of combining political life and constituency, because now all my colleagues are doing their constituency work online with groups. You know, it's just interesting how the pandemic has kind of really pushed this agenda.
And I think what it's also done is, you know, bringing broad issues to the fore that were always considered insolvable, you know, but the idea of, you know, are we looking at potentially remote voting, issues like that perhaps can be brought to the fore, which I think would improve the overall landscape, and being told it can't be done is probably not the answer anymore. Things can be done, yeah.
I push remotely all the time. I mean, I've been involved in every committee meeting. I've been involved in the plenary session. I spoke this morning on the Istanbul Convention and Turkey withdrawing from it in the European Parliament office in Dublin. I spoke directly into the plenary session of the Parliament. I have votes all day today in the Parliament. And I'm doing that from Dublin. I just get my ballot papers, I sign them. There's a system for them to go back in. I mean, you think about the flexibility that would give to Irish politicians. People are afraid it will be abused, but actually you can set up systems to manage it and make sure that it, you know, works effectively.
Let's put that on the agenda for the Family Friendly and Inclusive Parliament Forum and see where we get. Just want to take you back, I suppose, in the kind of campaigning piece, because a lot of the women that we work with really interested to know, I suppose, many of them have come from an activist background. So, you know, they've come with that purpose, that idea that they want to get involved in their community to change things. And one of the big decisions that they're facing at the beginning certainly is, do I join a party or do I get involved as an independent? And I think, you know, it's a huge decision at the beginning. You clearly went for the party option, and I know you can probably only speak about it from a Fine Gael perspective, but in general, what would you say to women coming forward who are struggling with that decision themselves at the moment, considering a run, party or independent?
Well, it's a challenging decision, Alison, that people have to make. I mean, first of all, you have to go where your values take you. I mean, you've got to see what political party, and it's worth exploring, you know, what political party kind of reflects your values best. Where do you think you'd like to be? Independents are increasingly sort of gathering together so that you're not quite as alone as independents often were before. Generally speaking, if you join a party, and hopefully this will increase in the future, like we've been talking about in relation to women, I mean, if the party is a big party, it's probably more likely to be in government. We are moving into a period of coalitions, though it would appear. So you have a chance to influence change at the highest level if you, you know, do go with the party. I mean, we've seen that a small number of independents have managed to do that. There may be more in the longer term. That would be a factor, I think. You know, where do you think the best opportunity to really influence national policy, if that's what you're interested in? Where is that going to be? And is that part of your goal? Or do you just want to be in the Dáil as a lone voice? And I don't mean that sort of in a derogatory way. Do you want to be in there as a voice, articulating a certain issue and not really getting involved in maybe other issues? That might be a determining factor. So I think you have to look at it very carefully and decide where you want to go. It's a changing scenario, probably moving more towards coalitions. You have to look at each of, you know, all of the parties in Ireland and say, you know, do you want to be part of influencing from that group, or do you want to join as an independent? I mean, you do have to be realistic as well. I mean, where are you living? What are, you know, if that's an option, what are the options in the area where I would be able to run? I mean, if there's two independents there already, or there's four, you know, X number, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Progressive Democrats, whatever, you know, like, are you going to have opportunity? You ask that about everything in life. Am I actually going to have the opportunity to run, to be supported, to win a seat? I mean, you've got to look at that very carefully. Is there room in the constituency? You've got to examine where you're living, the constituency, where you're living, and what are the opportunities? And you have to be realistic about that.
So that whole, that inter-part within the party, all of that, knowledge, do you have to get in to find it out, or you know, is it something that you can learn before you jump in?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think very often people aren't that well informed. And I was lucky. I got elected the first time I ran because Garrett was retiring, and I actually, won a seat. But my colleague at the time, who was somebody who'd been in the party a long time, who'd been a senator, who got elected, we didn't get the second seat. So he actually lost out. But that's rare enough for a woman to come in and take the seat. And of course, my party at the time wasn't happy about that at all. They were very disappointed we hadn't kept the two seats. I was thrilled to have been elected. And then suddenly I realized, of course, well, gosh, my colleague has lost. So the party aren't particularly happy because we've gone from two to one seat. But the Fine Gael vote was down at the time when I ran. And that's the other point about politics, that if your party is on the ascendant, or if your party's, time has come, a lot of women get, and a lot of men get swept in on that. If the party's fortunes are down, an awful lot of people lose, and it's outside your control very often. So, for example, when I lost my seat in 2002, all but three of Fine Gael TDs in Dublin lost their seats. And everyone was just swept away. Nearly didn't matter what work you had been doing, how hard you'd worked. That's the reality of politics as well. You know, if your party's fortunes, or if independence fortunes are down, that's what happens. So yeah, I think a lot of people don't really, maybe it's just as well because people keep going, but no, I think generally you should try and do, you should look at those issues. I mean, you should talk to people. I mean, people are very happy to talk to you who've been in politics, who are in a particular party, or even who've retired from politics. I mean, I would just say, inform yourself very well. Now, some people will, go on regardless of whether they think there's an opportunity. And sometimes there's opportunity that, depending on your motivation, you can create opportunity as well, of course, and create space. But that can be hard enough to do in politics. So I think, people really do need to get good, hard information, because even when you join a party, getting selected is a nightmare. It doesn't stop being a nightmare after you've been selected for the first time. It goes right through your career. Because as I said, there's always a challenger, always in politics. There's always somebody who wants to replace you. And that's very demanding. Just getting your nomination alone, you might think for people who've been there a long time, yes, for some it's easy. But, my experience was that it was ongoing. It's it's an ongoing issue about conventions and getting selected. That's just the nature of the business.
And I suppose that requires that resilience that you've talked about, and that toughness for male and female politicians just to continue going, even though essentially you've been fired. And there's not that many people in other careers that, would step back up and say, I'm going again to the same organization to ask the same people for their votes again when they've said no to me. So that kind of resilience is crucial. I suppose personally, you've had a number of ups and downs, but particularly the resignation piece in 2017, which was a very difficult situation to go through. You resigned and were subsequently completely vindicated in relation to that matter. But personally, how does that feel? And what have you learned from it? What would you say to other women that are considering coming forward and may have to face similar scenarios?
I couldn't begin to describe how tough it was. As anybody would imagine, I was on a trade missions the week before. I was Minister for Business. I had left Justice. I had finished in Justice. And this issue came up. And of course, there was a lot of misrepresentation, and that can continue to this day on social media. The critical point, of course, is that we were a minority government. And, dependent on Fianna Fáil. And once Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil took a certain position, then I decided, rather than creating an election at that point and in the best interest, really, of the both the country and the party, that I would offer, my resignation. But, you can imagine what that was like for somebody who was, full throttle in my work and utterly and totally committed to it. And, that was really a political and media frenzy at the time. Very, very difficult to deal with, almost impossible, as we know in these situations. And, of course, I'm a fan of majority government, obviously, because you can withstand these type of issues. But I'm also on the committee in the European Parliament now, that is examining, political interference and it's looking at populism and it's looking at Russia and China as well and how they're interfering in our current processes. And so, you know, I think we have to be very careful of populism. And, you know, like clearly there was a tribunal in place that we could easily, it was only a couple of months away, that was examining all of these issues. I had actually set up that tribunal, you know, which was just extraordinary to be then, you know, to be in the position I was in. But I suppose what I've learned is that, you know, how important, very tough, you know, absolutely. But, you know, you do find your resilience. I think if somebody hadn't the kind of resilience that I discovered I had, and I did that through the support from other people as well, my own family, my friends, particularly, of course, my family and friends and colleagues. If you don't have support, I think those kind of situations, and I've seen a lot of people in politics being treated very cruelly. I mean, that is the word I would use. I've seen a lot of injustice. And I was very struck when I did the Senate campaigns at some of the stories that both men and women told me about their experiences in politics. It can be very brutal. And I think, you know, people going into politics need to realize that. And you add in social media now, and I don't want to put anybody off because I've certainly had some of the best experiences of my life in politics, you know, and had the opportunity to influence change in a way that has been absolutely just so privileged and honored to have been in there. But I did consider, I did reconsider what I would say to young women and to girls and to young women about politics after that experience. I had to think very carefully about it because it was so brutal that I, you know, I really found myself thinking, you know, can I encourage women to go into something like this? And I came back to saying, absolutely, it is worthwhile. And I did find that resilience in myself to continue. And, you know, I would want to say to anybody who goes into politics, be sure you have that sort of resilience. And of course, in politics, you build resilience, like in any firm. I'm sure you've been through it yourself, Alison. You know, people in business have ups and downs and they build resilience too. And then they come back and you find them founding another firm or, you know, whatever. So I think there's lots of this in other parts of life as well.
I suppose that that whole theme of, you know, being the public aspect of so much of what you do by nature of the fact that you have to be elected and re-elected. We've seen some of that very public, I would say, lampooning of a politician this week, Mary Lou MacDonald's depiction as a witch in the Sunday Independent. And subsequently, I suppose, a fairly strong condemnation of that by all of the political parties coming forward. Do you think we need more of that? Where it's calling out what is happening and maybe seen as, you know, not standing for it as opposed to just allowing these things to happen?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think organisations and individuals should call out what they see happening to female politicians. I mean, I think it's very helpful to the female politicians, for people other than themselves, to call things out. And I think, but I have noticed over the years that organisations are often very reluctant to make comments about the political system, about what's happening, because they feel that they're getting involved in almost kind of party political issues or that they're interfering in some way. And there's, and particularly in Ireland, you don't see it in America so much, but there's a reluctance sometimes to call out what's happening to female politicians. And there have been some very obvious examples of it over the years, certainly in social media. I mean, we've all had an awful lot of name calling, you know, a huge amount of name calling. Now, men are in this space as well. I mean, a male colleague said to me recently, you wouldn't get up in the morning if you read what people say about you in social media. And that is true. So, I mean, this is a, you know, this is an issue. And by the way, you don't, of course, have to be in politics to experience this. I mean, this is a big societal issue for us in terms of violence against women, in terms of sexual harassment online, and the experiences of many women in that whole area. And I'm just talking about politics, but of course, it's not confined to politics, Alison.
Yeah. I'm going to take a few questions from, we've got a few questions in from attendees. Anna Doyle is wondering, is politics a young person's game, or does Frances agree there's a huge untapped potential for older women to get involved, bringing valuable experience and skill sets to the table? Is that something you would agree with?
Oh, absolutely. As I say, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And I actually think people who have experience in other areas, we should not just think about it as something for, you know, younger men or younger women. I absolutely would encourage women who've been in business because they have the experience, you know, who've raised their family, who want to contribute to public life, who are involved maybe in, you know, any of the many areas that women are involved in, whether it's, you know, school committees, community organizations, climate action, whatever. Absolutely bring that into politics. It's absolutely needed. You face all the same issues I've been talking about. You know, younger or older, you face those issues. But I just think that's a great question, because I think we need the mix of young and old, and we need the mix of young and older women. I was 42 when I went into politics. I had never thought about entering politics until my late 30s. You know, I was not involved in a Young Fine Gael or any, I was not political in college. I was totally cut up in doing my social work. So, you know, I think there's absolute scope as you go through life to think about going into politics. A lot of men do, a lot of men have sporting careers and then go into politics. Why not? Absolutely.
Okay. We have another question come in, and I suppose it's a very long question, but I suppose it relates to the fact of how do we bring that gender perspective or that gender lens to the civil service and the executive, so that the decisions are being made for the entire population as opposed to some of the population, and particularly male perspective.
Well, there's greater awareness of it now, Alison, for all of the reasons, because of the work that Women for Election do, because of the general move in society towards gender equality. I mean, it's, if you like, it's something that should always be there. But I remember many years when you couldn't talk about feminism, you know, the 90s, perhaps. It certainly, you know, gender equality was seen as kind of peripheral. Now it's absolutely central to our society. And I'm delighted to see that. The gender lens, yes. I mean, you need obviously more women in the civil service and senior levels. That's very important. We're seeing some really good progress there. We're seeing it in foreign affairs. We're seeing it ambassadors and so on. You're certainly getting quite radical changes, I think, in the civil service. You still need the critical mass in many areas of management that you don't have. So that's really important. And then you can have things like equality proofing, which we do on legislation. Make that more of a reality, perhaps have more exchange on
that. What does that actually mean, Frances, equality proofing on legislation? I mean, how does that work? Is it philosophical or a practical kind of view?
Well, you know what? It's kind of, to begin with, it's kind of a good idea, and then you've got to make sure it happens. So you take transport. You know, there are huge gender issues when it comes to transport, you know, about access, about safety, so on. So if you're bringing in legislation in relation to transport and you're bringing in, you know, anything from cycle lanes to whatever, you've got to look at the safety aspect. I mean, it applies to both women and men, of course, but there will be some specific gender issues. I mean, there's so every area you can have a gender lens, and I think it's really important. So if you're making agriculture policy, you know, you look at issues like, you know, well, what exactly women in agriculture at present might be more involved in agritourism? Are we giving supports there? Do we need training? A very good example now is new technology, AI. If we don't have, I mean, that's it. That's the future. And we have a 49% pension gap in Europe at present. So if you want to change that, women are going to have to move into those areas to ensure that they have good jobs in the future and good pensions. And so if you're talking if you're in the Department of Enterprise or Business, and you're talking about, you know, new training courses, well, what are the particular training courses that would be relevant to women as well as men? So I don't think we develop it enough, actually. Alison, you're right about that. We need to, if you like, define further in every area, and you need somebody kind of monitoring it from outside.
Yeah, and I suppose that question of what President Biden is doing in the US with his gender policy council, which I suppose has a very broad brief and an umbrella brief, essentially, to look at what's happening across so many different sectors. Do you think you need that oversight, or is it too much to ask each individual decision maker to take it as their own mission, I suppose?
You know, look at the more monitoring you have, the better, really. And the more people you have, I think, without duplication, obviously. But, you know, having sort of an organization like that, I think it's within government, isn't it, in the States at present. I think it's very interesting he's chosen to do that. I think you need mechanisms like that to make it an absolute reality. It's like monitoring the state boards. I had responsibility for that at one stage, and I asked all government departments to report, you know, on an annual basis. And you could see the shifts when it was being published on an annual basis. And if finance, for example, were making appointments to 10 boards and they had appointed, you know, three women or something, and then you sort of, you're publishing that, you're monitoring it, you have a target, you see it improving. So, yes, I think having people, you know, having somebody in government who's kind of monitoring this, it really does help.
Okay. A couple of comments in. Fiona O'Loughlin saying that Frances was very supportive and kind to women who entered Leinster House, regardless of party affiliation. Fiona thinks it's important because Leinster House can be a lonely place, especially when newcomers enter. So it's good to hear that. Is that something that you think you know, female politicians have a responsibility to do? I mean, clearly they need to be minding their own patch, and it's a competitive space. But that sort of sisterhood aspect of actually supporting women who made it through?
Oh, yes. I mean, I remember supporting Catherine Martin when she was bringing forward an amendment for payment for, I think it was for preterm babies. And I totally supported that. And I think she was very delighted at the time. She wasn't expecting it. She was in opposition. I remember doing that. And, you know, many issues like that. I think it's supportive where it makes a big difference. I think you can get it from men as well. And thank you, Fiona, for saying that. But it, yes, I think it does. And I've certainly, you know, mentored a lot of people in politics. But when I went in first, I remember somebody who sadly has died, Jim Mitchell. I remember him saying to me over a cup of coffee, "Do you know now what you need to do and how you're going to sort of do your constituency work and the kind of multidimensional challenge of politics?" And, you know, he sat down with me and did a map almost for me of what political life was like and, you know, the work you had to do. Now, obviously, I had a certain amount of knowledge, but I mean, he really, I just remember that. And I used to carry that piece of paper around with me for a long time because it's like a little map of all the boxes I had to tick. And, you know, you sometimes don't know all of the different elements. Of course you don't. If you're new to politics, you don't get it all. Now, a lot of women who come into politics now have been through local authority, of course. I hadn't at the time. And if you've gone through local authority, you certainly have learned the ropes there. And so I think it's great to see more women, and hopefully we can get a really extra percentage of women elected. And I know you've done amazing training with so many women who've expressed an interest in local politics. And often it's a bit easier. I suppose I've been talking about national politics, a bit easier sometimes to get started in local politics. And that's, I probably need to put that proviso in to what I have been saying, Alison.
Okay, just a question in. I suppose you've seen different institutions, electoral institutions at work between the European Parliament and councils and the Dáil here. If you were to bring something back from the EU that you think would improve our electoral process or system here, is there anything in particular that you've learned in the last couple of years there through your work in the European Parliament that you think would benefit our system?
Well, you know, we have a very adversarial system. And I think a lot of women aren't particularly taken with that. Sometimes it's adversarial for the sake of adversarial, and it's seen as kind of political advantage. The one thing that you see in the European Parliament is the constructive work you do, working with other parties, coming to a compromise and, you know, working out really good solutions. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, I'm stunned by it in the Parliament, how much is done, with very different from left to right and usually kind of a consensus in the middle. And I know, I think wonderful work comes out of the European institutions and the European Parliament. And it's not done in a hugely adversarial way. And I remember being in Sweden and seeing the Swedish Parliament and having the same view. I mean, our style of politics within the Dáil is highly adversarial. It's just one type of politics. I mean, there are other ways of getting a really good result for your citizens. It doesn't have to be, you know, sort of, you know, take their head off and, you know, make these sort of highly aggressive statements about people. And, you know, some of it is the cut and thrust of politics, but it's largely inherited from Westminster. There's other ways of doing business that don't need to be like that. And I actually think, you know, there's more constructive ways. And I think a lot of women would be more attracted to Irish politics if we took some of those lessons from the European Parliament.
Okay. Just one more comment, I suppose. You've been quoted really widely over the years saying that over 100 years since the foundation of the state, we have an unfinished democracy, I suppose, particularly in relation to gender balance. What are your hopes for changes on that? And we'll probably finish on this.
Yes, well, look at, I mean, obviously, I think, democracy, you know, it's ongoing, new challenges all the time. I think sometimes people have an idea, you know, this is democracy, this is what it looks like. Actually, it's changing all the time, has to get better, more representative, not just of women and men, but of, you know, all of the issues, you know, whether you're speaking about race, whether you're speaking about orientation, whatever. You know, we need the diversity of Irish life, you know, represented in the parliament. I would certainly like to see a really big acceleration of the numbers of women right across, you know, the Dáil, local authorities and the Senate. I just think this 22%, or even going to 25, 28, we've got to really try and have a big acceleration in a much shorter time frame. And we have to figure out the steps that are needed to that. We are impatient, we have to be more impatient, but we also have to have, as you've been asking me, you know, the demands have to be clear that it's not tolerable to continue with 22% or even in the 20s in the next 10 years. It really has to change in the next 5 to 10 years, the next elections. We have to see, and the parties and independents and everybody, we have to look at how we get to that point, because I think it has gone on for too long. I never thought over the course of my career that we'd still be at, you know, 22% in this year. So I think that's that acceleration. I mean, that's the work you're doing. That's the work the parties have to do. We all have to accelerate it, because you've got to get a critical mass of women across our democratic institutions.
Okay, thank you, Frances, for that. I would say we echo your impatience, and we absolutely echo your ambition for those numbers to increase. It's something that Women for Election are working on every day in terms of supporting and training women all around the country. And we look forward to your continued support for the work that we do, both here and obviously in whatever we can learn from in terms of the European Parliament. So thank you so much, Frances. I think you've been really open, and we've had a lot of questions in and a lot of comments. I suppose just your story is a role model for people, women who are looking to come forward. Your resilience to step back up when you've been knocked back down, I think, encourages everybody to face those challenges and continue to get involved. So thank you so much. I'm going to pass over now to Katrina, who's going to end the session for us. Thank you, Frances.
Thanks a lot, Alison. Thank you for asking those questions.
Thank you, Alison, and thank you, Frances. That's just been such a rich conversation. You can see it there in the comments and the engagements as well. Certainly testament to the experience you have, all that you've had to share with us so generously and so openly and so honestly. So look forward to linking with you more in the future, and to continue to pick your amazing mind and experience. Alison, thank you as well. It was a great interview, and thanks for being able to stand in. And I think there's so much people are going to take away from that, whether they're considering running, whether they're maybe hadn't thought about it when they came online today, or even maybe if they could think about who you know, because it's quite a critical time we're in terms of being able to generate the interest to get more women on the ticket to run. And I think what you're saying in terms of we're all tired of there not being enough women, and we all have to get, there's a team project for Ireland now. It's not just about Women for Election. It's not just about women. I think taking the weight off women's shoulders, more leadership from men. And I think one of the biggest takeaways I'm going to from the interview is we don't have to do it the way we've been doing it for the last 100 years. It doesn't have to be adversarial. We can have a new type of politic. We can have a new type of relating with each other and leading in a respectful way. So maybe that in itself will start to change the culture that's so so destructive, particularly in our social media world at the moment, towards politicians. Certainly in terms of Women for Election, I look forward to us doing more of the calling out of behaviour, because it's something that as bystanders we all have a role in doing, and I think that this week was testament to that in terms of what happened to Mary Lou MacDonald and to others over the years. So listen, thank you very much. You're very busy. Good luck with your new role as well, and we look forward to linking with you in the future. And Alison, thank you again. And for everyone listening, we're going to run this as a podcast in the next few weeks if you want to re-listen, and feel free to donate any spare cash you might have as well to help us continue to do more, if you've anything that you want to try on our website there. So until our next event, keep in touch, and thank you everyone.
Thanks, Katrina. Thanks very much indeed.
Many thanks again to our guests in this episode, Frances Fitzgerald MEP and Alison Cowser, Chairperson of Women for Election. We hope you enjoyed listening to the conversation. You can listen back to all our episodes wherever you find your podcasts, on social media and womenforelection.ie. You can also join our conversations on Instagram and on Twitter using the hashtag MoreWomen.